Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 4, Changes in Research Practices. Amy Kroll, Steve Stone, and William Young will discuss the impact of certain regulatory actions outside of the United States on research practices in the private fund industry. Now, on to the podcast.
You'll have heard about the MiFID II regime in Europe coming into force 3rd of January 2018. One of the most controversial areas is the research payment area, because it will be affecting life in the US. It's important, before we jump into the concept of unbundling, just to look at the fact that MiFID has a client's best interests rule up there in the top left-hand corner. And then below that, Article 24 of the directive effectively bans the receipt and retention of inducements by portfolio managers. There's another article, Article 23, on conflicts of interest, forcing investment firms in the EU to identify, prevent, or manage conflicts, including those caused by the receipt of inducements from third parties. And inducements cover fees, commissions, and monetary or indeed non-monetary benefits. And it's important to bear in mind that there are two exceptions, one for minor non-monetary benefits capable of enhancing the quality of the service, and then there's a safe harbour for research, investment research, that can either be paid out of the firm's own resources or can be paid for from a firm research payment account controlled by the firm, subject to rules.
So obviously a dramatic change from the status quo, where client dealing commissions, commissions or soft dollars as we understand here, will no longer be able to be used to finance the obtaining of research, at least for those jurisdictions subject or to the MiFID regime.
Thank you. Just a quick run through what is research. Very broadly, research must inform views, recommend a strategy, provide a substantiated opinion, analysis, and original insights. And then, of course, it's worth having a quick look at what might be minor non-monetary benefits, because those are also allowable. And those will be things like information about an investment or investment service which is generic, such as openly available macroeconomic material, or has been personalized to reflect the circumstances of an individual client. Conferences, seminars, and training events will qualify as minor non-monetary benefits, as will hospitality of a de minimis nature, short-term market commentary. And on corporate access, the European regulators split up the arranging of the corporate access or the concierge service, and they say that that is not research, and that the substantive corporate access may or may not be research, but the regulators do give an indication that oftentimes substantive corporate access may be classifiable as a minor non-monetary benefit and therefore not as an inducement, which is obviously good news. I mentioned the RPA, that's the research payment account, or the CSA plus if you like, and that will the portfolio manager will have to ensure that that's funded by a specific research charge to the client, which must not be linked to the volume or value of transactions executed on behalf of that client. However, the good news is the charge may be paid out of dealing commission, provided the research has been priced separately, or as we call it, unbundled. And a research budget must be set, regularly assessed, and agreed upon with clients, and any surplus remaining in the RPA at the end of a period must be rebated back to the client. Worth looking at the sell side briefly, the scope covers an EU broker to an EU portfolio manager, and not, I'm pleased to say, an EU broker to a US or other non-EU portfolio manager. Sell side must identify separate charges for these services that only reflect the cost of executing the transaction. And of course, the US sell side must do that, not because it's required to under MiFID II, but because portfolio managers in Europe are going to require it commercially. And the supply of and charges for those other benefits or services shall not be influenced or conditioned by levels of payment for execution services. Let's look at the EU impact. EU-based MiFID II qualifying portfolio managers, irrespective of the geographical location of the research provider and whether the provider and manager are part of the same group, are going to be impacted and must comply with this new regime. In the UK, we've heard that the FCA intends to gold-plate the scope of MiFID II in the UK by extending the investment research regime to managers of alternative investment funds under the AIFMD and to managers of UCITS funds under the UCITS directive. And it's not mandated to do that by MiFID II, which is why we call it gold-plating. And it's worth commenting more widely that other EU countries such as France, Ireland and Luxembourg will likely not follow the example of the FCA in that regard. So take that with a Brexit scenario and you've got a highly competitive landscape developing in Europe. Steve will shortly touch on the US impact. So going over to the next slide, this is a very interesting area, of course, because portfolio management these days is often housed in global portfolio management groups. A US delegate of a UK portfolio manager is quite a common scenario. And people are asking whether the US delegate will have to comply with MiFID II research for payments. And there seem to be two lines of thought. The UK manager will either be required to, when it delegates the US sub-manager, to enforce MiFID II research for payments contractually in all its glory, which is not a particularly desirable outcome for the industry. Or we think the better argument might be that the UK manager or the EU manager, although it must still comply with its own obligations under MiFID II, it doesn't have to force its US delegate to comply with MiFID II payment for research and can instead focus on how it can still comply with its own obligation to act in the client's best interests by examining, for example, whether the delegate has sufficient controls to ensure that explicit trading costs such as commissions and spreads are minimized, such that any non-monetary benefits received are proportionate to those costs, and it can seek to ensure that a rigorous system is in place in the US to assess the value of the research services that they use as part of the delegation. Another area, UK affiliates of a US portfolio manager, can the latter share research with the former that is paid for on a bundle basis under the US system? And clarity is very much needed here. There is an argument that provided that the UK affiliate gives a reasonable value to the research and pays for it out of their P&L, that will be sufficient. But we have yet to see that clarified. Or there are arguments that the US could mutate its own research into a house view, which it then disseminates intra-group. With that, I'll turn to Steve.
Thank you, William. In the cross-border applicability of MiFID II's inducements regime is highly complicated. It is evolving, and I guess the FCA is expected to come out with its paper sometime this month. And they have been more hawkish when it comes to cross-border issues, but there is an active debate being played off in London and the rest of Europe on those very issues. So going back to what Tim Lemon said at the very outset of the program, a lot of this is about regulatory clash. And so the basic framework of MiFID II clashes with our regime in a number of important respects. So on the sell side, that is for the broker-dealers publishing research, MiFID II would require that they accept cash compensation for research, either in the form of payments out of an RPA or out of investment manager P&L. That doesn't work with the US regime because receipt of cash compensation makes a broker-dealer an investment advisor, potentially under US law. But there are also clashes in terms of, is a CSA compatible with an RPA, so you can have transfers or you can have a single account that holds both balances? I think based on available guidance, probably not. But even more fundamentally, the issue that is looming large for cross-border firms is whether compliance with MiFID II regime necessarily takes you out of the safe harbor under 28E. And in that connection, for practices where you're trying to comply with MiFID II, you've lost the benefit, particularly the important shield under 28E against cross-subsidization claims. And while you can overcome that with disclosure, it doesn't help under the 40 Act or under ERISA that impose essentially an exclusive benefit rule. Let's break down the question on the screen, MiFID II coming on shore. The answer is it's already here. It's developing already in terms of the dialogue that many global firms are having both on the sell side and the buy side. To analyze the sell side impacts, as I mentioned, the receipt of cash compensation may well trigger investment advisor status, and that has two implications. Number one, makes them a fiduciary of which brokers don't wish to be because they're really intrinsically acting as counterparties, particularly when they act as a capital market participant and trade as principal. The other concern is under the Advisors Act, as you well know, investment advisors have to obtain client-by-client consent after disclosure of conflicts when affecting transactions on a principal basis. And so the challenge for the sell side has been really how do we ring fence the applicability of MiFID II, particularly when we're dealing with global managers who may be subject to the MiFID II regime or may choose for their own reasons, commercial or practical, to take a harmonious approach when it comes to the financing of research. And so there have been rumors that have been published in the press based on statements of various participants that some U.S. dealers may consider cutting off Europe in terms of their research. But at the very least, there are looming challenges when it comes to pricing stuff that has not been priced before, doing so in the framework where there is unresolved regulatory issue, including at the SEC, on the status of dealers as investment advisors in this context. And of course, there are longer-term economic worries about what happens when, or what is the profit in research and trade execution if the two are pulled apart. On the buy side, the challenges are also, when it comes to ring fencing, for the various reasons that William had articulated, which is that firms typically operate on a global basis, global investment teams, global trading desks, and it's very difficult in many cases to have a mandate that is staffed in London and New York to break down the transactions. There are also equally significant logistical challenges when it comes to budgeting and planning, particularly not knowing whether there will be relief from the SEC that would allow dealers to accept cash compensation. That has been a huge issue for European money managers, as well as the fundamental one, are money managers going to have to pay out of pocket, or will they get clients to essentially preserve the status quo by agreeing to fund an RPA-based mechanism? As we mentioned as well, there are a whole range of different U.S. regulatory issues on the buy side. This is not just a sell side issue. And they include, as I mentioned, the possible disruption in the ability to rely on the Section 2080 safe harbor, particularly for cross-subsidization. Also questions about whether money managers will need to disaggregate their transactions for MiFID-covered accounts versus U.S. 2080 accounts. Some of the SEC's guidance out there on trade aggregation, for example, the SMC No Action Letter, allow you to aggregate and to allocate based on the fill, but only if the accounts participating are paying the same cost for the shares, including the same commission rate. And if you strip that out, there could be questions, particularly under the Investment Company Act and Section 17D thereof. There are also, as I mentioned, differences between RPAs and CCAs, who owns them, where there is bankruptcy risk, et cetera, which will affect the ability to operate a consolidated RPA CSA. Among other things are things such as firms coming up with different determinations of the value of research for U.S. purposes, particularly where it may be valued at one level on the U.S. side, where you're paying with client dealing commissions as permitted by 2080, and perhaps different valuations, maybe lower, if a firm is paying out of their own pocket. More substantially, there is the growing concern on the buy side about the number of clients that may say no to soft dollars. We've seen that in some of the larger corporate pension plans and public pension plans, and how firms approach that. Many firms in the United States have approached clients who say no to say, well, you stay in the aggregated trades, but you pay the same rate, and we will simply disclaim earning credits. That may not work, will not work, in view of the restrictions or the requirements under MiFID II. And there's a lot more. So in terms of the key follow-up points or impact of this, I think that there is concern that MiFID II will be a tipping point for soft dollar research practices and full service commissions. The next 6 months will involve what can only be said as a mad scramble for greater regulatory clarity, both in the EU and the US, where the regulatory paradigms do clash. Money managers will increasingly have to pay for research with their own money as clients increasingly push back on the use of client assets to finance research. Decoupling research and commission valuations will drive down commissions. I guess that prompts the question, will fixed income spreads follow? Shrinking revenues for research and commissions could potentially decimate the ranks of broker-dealers for whom research and brokered services are not as profitable they had been in the past. And by the same token, Will those economic pressures also feed consolidation in the money manager side or create barriers to entry for smaller managers who struggle to pay for research or decide to go without it? Now, while hedge funds in the U.S. might be more removed from these regulatory and commercial effects, these practices could affect them, particularly if the hedge funds operate within a global organization. With that, I'll pass it over to Amy.
So I am going to speak a little bit about some normally what's called purely onshore issues. Those that have arisen over the course of the years since the SEC and FINRA began to regulate more heavily practices in the research area for broker-dealers for the sell side. Recently, there were a number of cases that were brought, both by the SEC and FINRA, that raised the issue of whether material that my guess is all of you in this room would have traditionally thought was outside of the definition of research might well be considered research. That is desk commentary, material coming off of the desks, both equity and debt, discussions coming from analysts, coming from traders, even the basic email correspondence that historically came from traders about what was going on in the market, what was going on with regard to particular names, what was going on with regard to particular credits at a particular time. That pale, that shadow of a doubt that was cast by these regulatory actions has given rise, not surprisingly, to a high degree of consternation by the buy side, by the trading desk personnel who have traditionally produced this desk commentary, and all the more so for their lawyers and compliance folks who are trying to make sure that that material does not give rise to regulatory issues. As a result, two steps have been taken by FINRA. One is in the debt area. When FINRA promulgated rules for the first time regulating debt research, they created a carve-out for institutional debt research. And that carve-out is intended to encompass any material that might hypothetically even fall within the definition of research, provided that the conditions of the carve-out are complied with, which allows for ongoing provision of desk commentary that might be of debt research coming out of a research department to institutional clients. You, as an institutional investor, you may well have been asked to provide affirmative consent or just reaffirmed by negative consent your willingness to receive this institutional debt research going forward. More complicated is in the equity space where there is no regulatory carve-out for institutional material, which means that desk commentary coming off of an equity desk that might fall within the definition of research could create a myriad of regulatory issues. And as a result, FINRA has recently proposed a safe harbor for desk commentary. And this is intended as a safe harbor for material that falls into the gray zone. The way it was proposed raised some concerns, and so it's not clear exactly what the safe harbor will look like. Hopefully, it will really allow for material that is not research, but that could lapse into the research domain that has brief analysis, that has information on near-term recommendations even with regard to near-term activity, and will allow for the unimpeded continued flow of material from both equity and debt desks without bringing on to both the sell-side firms the heavier regulatory framework that's imposed on research, but also allowing for the buy-side to continue receiving that material, which we understand is from time to time considered even more valuable than fundamental research, if you're looking, especially if you're looking at near-term analysis. One area that FINRA, like the FCA, has looked at is corporate access. And they understand that, to some extent, there is a need to ensure that corporate access does not slip into the research content. But they are looking at it, much as William described the regulators in the EU are, as bifurcated. There is providing corporate access, but there is also the writing, the follow-up, which has not been unusual, that is disseminated to a wider range of clients than those who actually participated in corporate access events. the writing may well fall within the definition of research and may need to be changed, as much other practice may need to change to ensure that it falls under the safe harbor once it's adopted for desk commentary or the institutional debt research exemption if the writing is about a particular issuer's, for instance, credit structure. What does that mean for you on the buy side? One, you may see some changes, you may already be seeing changes in the nature of the content that you receive from the sell side. That content change is so that product does not fall into the research regulatory rubric. The second is, you may find that you are being asked to provide consent to receive the content from the sell side firms. This is so that they'll satisfy the obligations imposed on them by the regulators to continue providing that content to you, either under the debt research exemption, or, I mean, the institutional debt research exemption, or under whatever the ultimate desk commentary safe harbor looks like. In both instances, hopefully it won't significantly impact your use of the material, but we did want to alert you to these changes because you will be seeing the ramifications in your day-to-day business. William, do you think any of this will, circling back, the changes that we'll see on the US side, could they impact the views of, for instance, if information is provided to EU portfolio managers, will that bring us back under the MiFID rubric, or are we going to be okay here in our little corner of the US?
In Europe, we'd have to look at the desk commentary you've outlined to see whether it is research under the rather long and complicated definition in MiFID II, or whether it is a minor non-monetary benefit. Now, there may be examples of desk commentary here, some of which fall into the research bucket and some of which fall into the minor non-monetary benefit bucket, and that will be an analysis we need to make. It's important to note that ESMA has already said that short-term market commentary on latest economic statistics or even on company results is not to be regarded as research, but as a minor non-monetary benefit.
Okay, so it seems like more to come. With that, I think we're done. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.